From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Pesticides have blanketed the planet. They're protecting our plants from crop-killing diseases, keeping our yards weed-free, and increasing the valuable produce our fields produce each year. Many are also carcinogenic, getting into our food, our skin, our lungs. We're using more and more each year to combat the pathogens they hold at bay, as those pathogens are growing ever more resilient. Researchers and farmers are looking for alternatives and ways to use these powerful chemicals more wisely. This hour on Point, keeping our growing global pesticide use in check. You can join us on air or online. Do we rely too heavily on pesticides to keep our food coming, to keep malaria at bay? Can we ever make pesticides obsolete? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. With me first this hour from New Era, Michigan, is Eric Stockstead, staff writer at Science Magazine. He and his team were behind this month's special issue on smarter pest control and global use of pesticides. Eric, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane.
So why dedicate an entire issue of the magazine to pesticides?
We were struck by a number of incidents earlier this year. Obviously, pesticides go back decades as a tool for world agriculture, but we were struck by a number of really sad incidents earlier this year. One was the inadvertent killing of a huge number of bumblebees out in Oregon when trees in a parking lot that were in bloom were sprayed at the wrong time, and just a huge death of bumblebees there. And then even worse, in India, the tragic death of a number of school children who were inadvertently poisoned by contaminated food from an old pesticide jar. And then things happening on the policy front where the European Union earlier this year went ahead with a moratorium on several kinds of insecticides because of fears for damage to pollinators. So we decided to step back and kind of get the whole picture of how pesticides are used, what some of the problems are, what exactly are the benefits, and then a real look at kind of the science that's coming up to help improve these useful chemicals and to try and use them more wisely.
So give us the numbers. Help us understand how much pesticides we are using globally.
It's an enormous amount, and that's really reflects the face of agriculture on the planet. Really, so much of the land surface is used for growing food. And aside from fertilizer, which of course is used almost everywhere, pesticides are applied in tremendous quantities. The latest global figure we found was from the Environmental Protection Agency, which cited 2.5 billion kilograms all over the world in 2007.
And how does that use shift from country to country around the world? It does vary greatly.
It does, and in fact, there are probably some places where not enough pesticides are used because food yields could really go up where there aren't enough. But what we found was that North America, for example, the United States and Europe, in those places, pesticide use is fairly high and it's holding steady. But in other places, like Africa, it's really quite low. And then in between, we see a rising trend in countries like Brazil, India, China, where they're industrializing, their food needs are going up rapidly, and lots of pesticides are being added into their food system.
I'm looking at some of the numbers from your article here. In the U.S., we put 2.2 kilograms per hectare of land. That's about 20% of total pesticide use in 2007. Those are the latest numbers. In China, compare that to 10.3 kilograms per hectare. So 2.2, 10.3, that's a huge difference.
Right. Now, so what that means is that pesticides are being used more intensively on each farm in China than they are here. And it also means that, you know, we have a lot of land here where we don't, we grow things, but we don't use pesticides. So the other factor to keep in mind is in some places like China or Southeast Asia, farmers are using more pesticides than they actually have to. And in some places that can inadvertently reduce the amount of food that they're growing. And that's sort of counterintuitive, but the reason is if you use too many pesticides, you'll accidentally kill the beneficial insects. And those beneficial insects are ones that, if they lived, they would help eat up the pests that you're actually worried about.
Hmm. You mentioned that Africa has a particularly low demand for pesticides. Why is that?
Partly it's because the farmers there tend to be poor, so they can't afford it. And just the infrastructure there in Africa in terms of getting supplies to farmers and getting food to markets is much less developed than it is in the rest of the world.
How does pesticide use in the U.S. compare now to, say, a decade ago, 10, 20 years ago?
Pesticide use overall is holding fairly steady. It went up quite a bit in the 60s and then 70s. And then starting, I would say, in maybe about the 1990s, it has started to taper off. And there are a couple of things happening here. One thing to remember is that in the U.S., 20%, one-fifth of pesticide use is actually not used on farms. There's a whole lot of lawns that are taking up a lot of pesticide.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
There's household use. So what we've seen is that the Environmental Protection Agency and industry have started to take off the market the more dangerous chemicals. So we've seen a decline in the insecticides, for example, that we're really worried about in terms of human health effects. And the other thing that's changed is the advent of genetically modified crops.
Hmm.
So that has also shifted the way that pesticides are used here. And we're thinking, when we say pesticides, more broadly than just killing insect pests, but also herbicides, so weed killers. So the big trend with genetically modified crops is we've seen the advent of BT corn. So that's corn that's been engineered to create its own insecticide inside the plant. Same thing with cotton. And what that means is farmers aren't spraying as much insecticide as they used to on those fields because the plants are making their own.
They're actually developing immune systems that ward off these fungal and bacteria and viral diseases. Is that right?
That's cutting edge. That yet is not on the market. So what's interesting is plants actually have their own immune system. It's not just animals that have an immune system. And as people have bred plants, you know, for hundreds of years, they've selected varieties that are more naturally resistant to pests. And scientists are getting better at figuring out how that happens and how you could actually breed that in a smarter, more effective way.
What about organics? Do organic pesticides work? Are they a valid option? Are they being used?
They are. In fact, what the difference between organic and non-organic food in terms of pesticide use is that non-organic farmers can use synthetic pesticides, so chemical pesticides that have been synthesized in a factory. Organic farmers can't use those synthetic pesticides, but they can use other ways of treating insect damage. So they use things like sulfur compounds or oils or soaps. What's interesting is they also use this BT spray, which comes from a soil bacterium. So organic farmers will use that. Now, what that means is they have fewer tools at their disposal. So sometimes there may be problems that they can't handle as well as a conventional farmer could. Now, the flip side, and there are lots of flip sides and trade-offs here, is that organic farmers get more benefits from those beneficial predators because they will have less collateral damage from the insecticide.
We tend to think in this part of the world as pesticides being dangerous, but in places in the developing world, goodness, they have done a lot of good in protecting children, especially against malaria. Tell us a little bit about that.
That's absolutely true. Malaria is a devastating disease just terrible losses for children and adults, especially in Africa and other tropical areas. What has made a real big difference is spraying insecticides inside the household to kill mosquitoes, and also, and this is probably even better, is having bed nets, so fabric netting that can go over the bed at night. And if it's treated with insecticides, it's much more effective at preventing the mosquitoes from coming in and spreading malaria than ones that don't have the insecticide. So it's hard to get in a lot of these things with health effects. It's hard to get really solid numbers. But there was an interesting study that came out and tried to do a modeling, a scenario, and come up with an estimate of how much good these two techniques do. And it found, you know, for example, in Nigeria that 150,000 childhood deaths could have been prevented over the last decade by these two techniques of spraying for insects.
It's incredible. The numbers really are striking. I'm curious what surprised you, Eric, the most about pesticide use in the United States and or globally?
Well, two things. One thing in the U.S. is I was putting together this graphical overview of data about what we call Pesticide Planet, was how hard it was to get really good, clear data about health effects, and especially about health effects for farm workers. That was really tough to get as good a picture as about finding out exactly how beneficial these are for crops. So, you know, one problem there is that just the tremendous amount of farm poisonings from pesticides mm-hmm. just don't go reported. So people don't report their symptoms either because, you know, they may not have access to medical care or they may be worried about the consequences of that. So it was really hard to get sort of the full picture about what the human burden, especially for farm workers, is. The other thing, and this was really striking, was the suicide factor, and that pesticides, where they are very accessible in the developing world, they're used as a way for people to commit suicide.
Mm-hmm. Well, we'll talk more about that and much more after this break. We're talking about the global use of pesticides and how we can improve our use of these very powerful chemicals. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at pesticide use around the world this hour and smarter alternatives to these powerful chemicals. With me this hour is Eric Stockstead, staff writer at Science Magazine. He's one of the authors behind this month's special issue on smarter pest control. And joining me now from University Park, Pennsylvania, is Edwin Rajat, professor of entomology and integrated pest management coordinator at Pennsylvania State University's College of Agricultural Sciences. He works with USAID's Integrated Pest Management Innovations Laboratory as a co-principal investigator for South Asia. Professor, nice to have you with us. Thanks for your time.
Greetings from Penn State, Jane.
Thank you. Walk us through the history, Professor, of pesticide use in the United States.
Well, pesticide use in the United States started in the late 1800s, where they recognized that some chemicals, mainly paint constituents, were able to kill insects. From that discovery, a pesticide industry grew, and then into the 1930s and 1940s, where a lot of chemical research was being done to, for warfare, so to speak, they noticed that many nervous toxins that they were developing for killing soldiers, I guess, would work against insects. And so after World War II, the pesticide industry in the United States and elsewhere in the world really blossomed and grew quite a bit and pretty much dominated pest management into the 1960s when they started to notice that things weren't going as well as they thought. They were starting to see resistance in pest populations. They started to see other animals being affected by pesticides. They found that the pesticides were becoming less effective as pests became resistant, and they would use more combinations of pesticides and more quantity of pesticides. And then with Rachel Carson's book, Silent Spring, published in 1962, it kind of brought this situation to the public. And through the 60s, with Earth Day and the kind of environmental awareness, the attitude of the public changed. We had the establishment of the U.S. EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, in 1970, and that's really when the Integrated Pest Management Program was established nationally.
Hmm. How is it that chemicals that we have stopped using here in the United States have now ended up in many places in the developing world?
Well, chemicals that we use in the United States are the product of innovation by chemical companies and research programs, et cetera, but they're also kind of capped or direct or given a certain direction by regulation. So our government here has a very strong regulatory process for pesticides. All pesticides have to meet certain standards. They have to – there are educational programs that have that pesticide applicators have to go through. So it's a quietly – it's a quite tightly managed system here. If you go to another country, especially in developing countries, the regulatory framework is quite weak. And so – so you don't see the kind of counterbalancing regulatory force on pesticide use.
And how many products and agriculture in the U.S., how much of that comes from places overseas where pesticide is used much more heavily than it is here? That is to say, do we feel the impact of the billions of gallons or billions of kilograms that are being used elsewhere here?
Well, you know, we get – especially in the wintertime, we get a lot of our food from other countries, from South America and other places where they can still grow vegetables and fruit. And, you know, they're using pesticides in these places. But I forgot the year, but I think Ted Kennedy was sponsored legislation back in probably the – I don't know, maybe the 80s or 90s called Circle of Poison legislation, where food that was imported into the United States had to meet the same standards as the food that was grown in the United States. So I think that's kind of moderated things quite a bit. And it, the pesticide residues on imported food are monitored to a certain extent.
You've worked with farmers on the ground here and around the globe. What are the reasons they give you for using pesticides in high concentration?
Well, a lot of times the farmers that I work with, not so much in the United States, the farmers here are very sophisticated farmers, and you know, and pesticides cost money, and they're not going to be, you know, wasting money if they don't have to. And so there's a lot of integrated pest management that goes on here, where alternatives to pesticides can moderate the cost of pesticides for the farmer. But in other countries where the you know, the research and education infrastructure isn't there, a lot of farmers are just unaware of the alternatives or of more clever or more knowledgeable ways of using the pesticides. The other thing with the developing countries is many of the farmers are illiterate, so that you only have certain ways of reaching them through an educational program.
We have a lot of calls. Let me get some in here. First up is Adam in Northampton, Massachusetts. Adam, welcome to the program. Hello.
Hi, Jane. Hi. I was a field operations manager on a 1,600-acre farm from roughly the mid-'80s to the mid-'90s. So we were a conventional farm, and we used quite a bit of spray applications, pesticides, herbicides, both. And my basic takeaway from this was that when people want really large scales of economy in agriculture, that it's just cheaper to do things with pesticides and herbicides than to try other methods of cultivation, which could potentially reduce the need for it. If you have a 500-acre field of peppers or eggplants, it makes a very, very tempting target for bugs to move into, and then they metastasize throughout the system really quickly. But if we were breaking up things into smaller allotments, or if we were sending in more hand labor to remove weeds, which can provide safe harbor for insects, so what really winds up happening is you wind up with a inversely proportional relationship. You could use, yes, less pesticides, but it would mean more sophisticated management, and it would mean oftentimes a more expensive type of management.
I hear it, Adam. If you want cheap food, if you need efficiency and you need chemicals, is what he's saying, Professor Rajat. What do you say to that? Is there a direct correlation between pesticide use and cheaper food? No way around it.
To a certain extent. I mean, we do have kind of a cheap food policy in the United States. So food prices are held down, and we support agriculture through other transfers of wealth to the agriculture sector, like land-grant universities and various conservation payments that are made to farmers, et cetera. But I think the key word that the caller said is cheap. And you know, that's right. If you go just on the economics of it, maybe on a large farm, the use of pesticides might be the cheaper alternative. But on the other side of the coin, you have the consumer. And the consumer, if they are educated and this is an important issue to them, is actually willing to pay more for their food. Hence the the organic movement and the organic standards established by USDA. So it's a kind of a moving target, and there's two sides to the cost of production issue. And if you look at organic farmers who are doing quite well, and yeah, maybe they have smaller farms, but they have a consumer marketplace that is willing to pay the extra cost.
Here's another call from Laura in Des Moines, Iowa. Hi, Laura, you're on. Welcome.
Hi, Jane. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Well, I'm so glad you're having this show today. It's so important to me. I know a lot of people it is to them, too. And I think what you're talking about with education and, people just don't know. Like the gentleman was talking about farmers not really realizing their alternatives or maybe even the proper use of these chemicals. I have a cleaning business, and in the cleaning business world, the rates of people being sickened from the cleaning products mm-hmm. that they're using in these businesses is very high. And in my business, we use all non-toxic cleaning products, and they're out there. There's just tons out there. People just need to get out there and know, first of all, what this stuff is doing to them and how bad it is for their families, their children, their animals, not just their pets, but also their farm animals. I am one of those people. I will pay a dollar more for something that is organic or at the very least chemical free.
Laura, thank you. Your comment leads nicely into the next voice I'd like to add into this conversation. Joining me now from Oakland, California is Brenda Eskenazi, professor of maternal health and epidemiology at the University of California, Berkeley School of Public Health and the director of the Center for Environmental Research and Children's Health. She heads the center's ongoing research in how chemicals and other factors related to the environment impact children's health. Professor, welcome to On Point.
Hello, Jane.
So you've looked at the impact that pesticides have had on young children who grow up near fields where they spray pesticides. What did your research find?
Well, we studied primarily one class of pesticides called organophosphate pesticides or organophosphorus pesticides. These account for about 35% of all insecticides used in the United States. About 30 million pounds are used per year in the United States, and most are used in California because it's the leading agricultural state in the nation. We looked at exposure to organophosphates by looking at chemicals that are excreted in the urine as a measure of the person's exposure during pregnancy, and we found that there was a relationship with the child having abnormal reflexes as a neonate, as a newborn, decreased mental development during toddler years and as well as school years, and an increase in attentional problems in the children.
Hmm. Beyond the effect in utero, what are some of the other aspects of pesticides and health effects? What are you seeing? What did your research show?
Well, we are most concerned about fetuses and children because they're more susceptible to chemical exposures. Many chemicals, it's not usually known this, but go through the placenta and also into the brain. And we know that developing organs are more sensitive, and also fetuses and children are less likely to get rid of these chemicals. Also, children have higher exposures because they actively explore their environment. We all know that they constantly putting their hands to the floor and putting their hands in their mouth, and they're playing near the ground, and they're eating and drinking and breathing more than adults are. So we're more concerned about fetuses and children.
But just to interject here a little bit, I'm seeing all sorts of reports, from Reuters, AP. I've got reports here in front of me, pages long, the wide ranges of diseases linked to pesticides, from Alzheimer's to asthma, birth defects, prostate, breast, brain cancer, lymphoma, developmental learning disorders, ADHD, Parkinson's. I mean, the list goes on. That's all valid and fairly new research, is it not?
Well, I think it's very complicated. First of all, not all pesticides are the same. People often class them together, but there are different classes of pesticides. I've studied the organophosphorus pesticides, but you know, years ago in the United States, we used many organochlorine pesticides, which, for example, DDT, which was banned in the 1970s in the United States, still commonly used in Africa for malarial control. So not all pesticides are the same, and so when we say, for example, that lymphoma and Parkinson's are related to pesticides, we need to be very specific about which pesticides. The problem that we have with any of these studies on the effects of pesticides in health is being able to really estimate whether people are exposed. And in California, we're unique in that all the pesticide applications that occur in agriculture are reported to the state. And so we know where pesticides are applied, but we're the only state in the nation that does that. And so we don't really, when we say pesticides are linked to Parkinson's disease, in many places we don't know if there are individual levels of exposure.
What about pesticide use and depression? You had some interesting research bits on that, especially cancer trend or depression trends among farmers that lead to perhaps other potentially more devastating impacts.
Well, that's actually two ways. People poison themselves with pesticides, if, for example, to commit suicide intentionally. And then also unintentionally it happened, because we know that hundreds of farm workers every year are poisoned by pesticides, not necessarily resulting in death, but can result in illness. But in addition, we are seeing a growing body of evidence that exposure to, for example, pesticide applicators in the United States or their spouses may be related to depression. And this makes some biological sense because of how these chemicals act on the brain and nervous system.
And so once you're exposed to pesticides, does it change your DNA? Is there anything you can do to reverse the damage?
That's a very interesting question. We are now looking at something called epigenetics. You can't change your DNA, but you can change how enzymes respond to that genetic code. And we are looking at that right now. There's virtually little information on that. There is a lot, however, people can do to prevent exposure. And I think the speaker before me spoke about IPM, integrative pest management in the field, but there's also integrative pest management in the homes and how to prevent exposure to children and to pregnant women and to yourselves. Mm.
Professor Rajat, what do you make of what you've just heard about the link between pesticide use and depression, especially among farmers who use the pesticides?
Well, first, let me say I'm not an expert in human physiology or anything like that. But Brenda brings up a good example of the organophosphorus pesticides. Those are the ones that were developed after or during and after World War II. And it was recognized in the 90s that children especially were some more severely impacted by these organophosphorus pesticides. So because they had smaller bodies and they ate more fruits and vegetables per kilogram, that type of thing. And so actually Congress acted, and in 1996 they passed the Food Quality Protection Act, which has resulted in actually the removal of many of those organophosphate insecticides from the market. So that's one way the regulatory process works. But what we do is we use integrated pest management. Pesticides are important, and they will remain important. It's just the kind of the misuse of pesticides that causes the problem. We try to combine all different tactics to control pests into a package to provide for the farmers so that they're using alternatives to pesticides and only using pesticides when they're absolutely necessary.
Do farmers worry about the exposure? I mean, I hear you saying many of them are using IPM, integrated pest management techniques, but do they worry about the exposure and the impact to their own health because of their use of pesticides?
Well, not only that. I mean, they deal with pesticides on maybe a daily basis, but, you know, a lot of times their family lives on the farm, and so their family potentially is exposed. So they worry about it, and that's why they, U.S. farmers, and we read up on it, they have to take training in how to use these pesticides safely. They have to wear a certain kind of clothing when they apply them. So it's like any chemical. You take precautions if you have to use it.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're looking at how we can use pesticides more effectively around the globe. With me this hour is Eric Stockstead, staff writer at Science Magazine, Edwin Rajat, professor of entomology and integrated pest management coordinator at Pennsylvania State University, and Brenda Eskenazi, professor of maternal health and epidemiology at UC Berkeley. A couple of comments from our website. Here's Gary, who says, as someone who has a big Japanese beetle problem, I'm grateful grateful for a product which quickly kills these pests. I love perfect-looking trees and grass and do not want ragged leaves because of these pests. There's another one from Creeker. She says, one thing I've read more of lately is, even if pesticides are perfectly safe for humans, they affect the flora in our intestines that can potentially lead to all sorts of problems. A lot of viewpoints on our website, a lot of concern. Some people who think pesticides need to be used. Here's Tara from Penyang, New York. Tara, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Oh, hello, Jean. Thank you very much for taking my call.
Of course.
I was just calling. I work and live on an organic grape farm here in New York, and I have the certification that the state requires to purchase even the organic pesticides that we have to use here. And I had the good fortune to also work in the developing world for a couple of years as an agricultural educator for small farmers. And I have to say, when we talk about reducing pesticide use, not just here in the States, but, you know, especially in the developing world, we need to also consider the amount of resources that have to be invested in farmer education and in professionalizing the entire, you know, system, the agricultural system, really, abroad, because IPM and, you know, organics and all of these things, they're wonderful, but it's so complicated. There's so much that goes into it. And your average, even a large farm, lots of times in the developing world, are sort of stuck in what we used to have in the mindset here. We just throw some spray into a plane and fly overhead, or, you know, small farmers that spray all sorts of chemicals with very minimal protections or understanding of what it is they're killing or what they're putting on or how.
Can I ask you, Tara, as a certified organic grape farmer, is it harder for you as a farmer to grow food without pesticides? Is it more trouble?
Oh, yeah. We have reduced yields. It depends a lot. As you know, farming, we're sort of slaves of nature, so it's going to depend on the year. This year, for example, we're going to lose a lot more crop than folks who would be farming conventionally to insects, because, you know, we're not allowed to use, you know, we don't use the synthetic insecticides and insecticidal soaps. I have less effectiveness and have to be applied more frequently, especially in rainy weather like we've been having. It's a trade-off that usually we figure economically it's pretty close, but, you know, we don't want to use, we live here, so we try, you know, we don't want to use the real toxic stuff that used to be. And you can see a difference in wildlife, at least. I notice I'm, you know, 40 almost, and I see a difference in the amount of wildlife, especially birds and stuff, that we have around now that we didn't when I was a very small child, and, you know, the environment was still recovering from, you know, widespread use of really toxic.
Tara, thank you very much for the call. I appreciate that perspective. Here's Lewis in Hamden, Connecticut. Lewis, welcome to the program. Hello.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for taking my call.
Of course.
So I first wanted to really reiterate what the gentleman mentioned earlier, that pesticides are designed to kill. And I think that it's really dangerous for us to just assume that because we find these products on the shelves at various chain stores and things like that, because they have the EPA label on them, that they're safe to use and that they're not having, that we're just assuming that they don't have the same kind of deleterious effects on humans and wildlife that they were designed to have in the first place. I would also add that recently the EPA took a huge step announcing that they would be implementing new restrictions on a certain class of pesticides, the neonicotinoids, basically recognizing the role that these products play in advanced colony collapse disorder. In the bee colonies, affecting our pollinators. This creates instability in our food chain, potentially jeopardizing our food security. And so now that the federal government has taken steps to recognize this problem, I believe that it's really up to us as consumers and as members of the public to step up to the plate and put pressure on those retailers, those stores that are carrying these products, and say, we don't want these products. This is bad for our environment. And to also hold our local government accountable, you know, at the state and at the community level.
Got it, Lewis. Thank you very much. Let's turn back to Eric Stockstead. You've done a lot of research on this. Eric, talk specifically about these new EPA standards for the neonicotinoids.
Well, I think what EPA did was require new labels that are more pollinator-friendly, so that make clear what you should and shouldn't be doing with these in order to protect pollinators. Now, one tricky thing about the neonicotinoids is that they are often used as what's called seed treatments. So the seed itself is coated with this insecticide, and then it is incorporated throughout the plant. So the concern there is that these neonicotinoid insecticides are showing up in the pollen and the nectar of the plant, so they may be collected by bees. Exactly how much of an effect these are having compared to other threats isn't really clear. What is known is that bees are having a lot of problems, commercial honeybee hives, 30% loss rates year after year. So it really is, bees are having a problem. But one interesting thing is that the varroa mite is this terrible problem for bees. That's known to be a big threat. And beekeepers are applying a kind of pesticide called miticides that kill these mites directly into the hive. So one thought is that these miticides might be having a big impact on the bees as well. So it's kind of a damned if you are and damned if you're not as a beekeeper.
But still plenty of questions and not a lot of answers. Here's Mark in Rockton, Wisconsin. Mark, welcome to the program. Hello.
Hi, Jane.
Hello.
I just want to emphasize that unlike a lot of other environmental factors that are impacting our health, we have some control here through the marketplace. The organic movement has grown tremendously. It represents about 10% of fruits and vegetables now, as an example. And so we can vote on what kind of agriculture we want. And not just in our food, in our homes, how we care for our homes and gardens. The impacts of these are not just on the food, the chemical, agrochemical residues in the food, but we have endemic levels of a pesticide contamination in our groundwater supplies for much of America. Atrazine, which is one of the most commonly used corn herbicides, is found in most rural water systems. So not only are we protecting our own families, we're protecting our neighbors, we're protecting, by choosing organics, we're protecting the farmers and the children of farm workers that so often live contiguously to the fields. Last point I'd like to make is, we've heard some laudatory language about IPM, integrated pest management.
Mm-hmm.
Jane, that's just conventional agriculture. These chemicals produced by Monsanto and other large suppliers are incredibly expensive, and farmers are not just randomly applying these any longer. They're scouting their fields for pest pressure. They're applying them in more judicious levels, but they're still highly dangerous. This is not a new trend. This is the standard right now. The GMOs are losing their effectiveness because the weeds are growing resistance, the pests are growing resistance, so we're now having to increase herbicide and insecticide use and come up with cocktails of multiple chemicals. So the real answer is to use cultural practices. The organic pesticides are even more expensive than the synthetic, so that's the last resort for organic farmers, and we should be going toward that better management form.
Mark, thank you very much. I appreciate your insight. Ed Rajat, what do you say to all that?
Well, I'm glad that he brought up IPM. I think it's a little bit more advanced than he's letting on. For instance, in South Asia, in Nepal and Bangladesh, we've developed a method where there was a disease in the soil called bacterial wilt that would wipe out whole fields of eggplants and tomatoes, and we developed a way of taking a resistant rootstock from a wild plant, putting the tomato or eggplant on top of that, and that resistant rootstock prevented the bacterial disease getting up into the plant. So there was a kind of a cultural practice that would substitute for pesticide use. We use insect pheromones, which are chemicals that insects use to attract each other for mating, et cetera, to confuse populations of pests, and that's worked very well in Bangladesh. So we have a lot of tools in the toolbox that are alternatives to pesticides, and pesticides are in that toolbox also. And our job is to blend all these things together to make a pest management program that is economical for the farmer, preserves the environment, and is as safe as can be to humans. Those are the three goals of integrated pest management.
Here's Ted in Boston. Ted, welcome to the program. Hello.
Hi, Jane.
Hey.
Thanks so much for doing this important topic. I'm a new dad. I've got 15-month-old twins, and we've switched over to organics with everything that we buy because we just feel that it's one of the most important things we can do for our kids, and we really feel like the solution is worse than the problem in terms of the so-called solution of pesticides is worse than just trying to do other things like buying organic and making sure that our kids are not exposed to things. And there was a comment earlier in the program where one of your people made it sound like, you know, he said other countries, they use a lot more pesticides and were much more regulated. But my understanding is that the big agribusinesses really control what gets approved, what doesn't get approved, have a lot of sway, as we say, with their lobbyists. And we're the guinea pigs. You know, we're sort of living in this chemical soup. In Europe, they have to prove something is safe before it goes in the market, and here they have to prove consumers have to prove something is unsafe before it's taken off the market.
So. Ted, I hear it, and I'm glad that you called. Eric Stuckstedt, will you speak to that agribusiness and its huge lobbying influence?
Well, obviously, they do have a lot of sway, but I would return to the point that Dr. Rajat made about the Food Quality Protection Act in 1996, and what I think that really shows is the effect that political movements can have, because that really did motivate the removal of a number of very dangerous insecticides from the market. So I think, you know, citizens can speak, and if enough speak, politicians listen.
Brenna Eskenazi from University of California, Berkeley School of Public Health. Talk to me about your biggest concern about pesticides and what research is done on their impact on people before they hit the market.
Well, I think that my biggest concern is that we have virtually no research on most classes of pesticides and their effects on human health. So, for example, glyphosate or even the pyrethroids, we don't have many studies on whether they do affect human health. So that's my biggest concern. I think that, you know, we tend to regulate pretty well, as best as we can, chemicals before they enter the market, but it's based on certain hypotheses about how these chemicals act, not by direct research on human health. And so we're making inferences from animal studies or in vitro studies by how these chemicals work on the body. Can I just respond to another comment about IPM?
Okay.
And the gentleman that just called in. It's important, if you're eating organic foods, to also think about IPM in the household, that many people still don't wash their fruits and vegetables well, even if they are eating organic, and that's important that they do. Because there's also bacterial content on fruits and vegetables, but also to use more traps and less sprays in the homes and to make sure you wash your children's hands and surfaces. All of these things will reduce pesticides in the homes that may either come in from outside or because you're using them. And so I think that we've been focusing in this call on agriculture, but we also need to think about housing and what we're doing in our homes, on our pets, and what we are responsible to control.
Got it, Professor. Thank you. Let's go to another call. Brian from Hilton Head, South Carolina. Brian, you're on the air. Hello.
How are you doing, Jane? I just wanted to make a point. I come from an agricultural background. I kind of grew up working on a family farm, and we grow a fair number of vegetables, and one of them is sweet corn. And, you know, I think people need to be a little more realistic about what to expect. I mean, you have to be willing to shuck an ear of sweet corn and find a caterpillar and not get really, really upset if you want to be able to do it in a friendly manner. Because otherwise, you're spraying sweet corn in the southeast from tassel to harvest every other day with a synthetic pyrethroid insecticide to control worms.
Mm-hmm.
I think people need to know that and be willing to accept the alternative.
Brian, thank you very much. Professor Rajat, do consumers need to change their expectations? You know, the produce is not going to look perfect.
Well, you know, that's been, the situation all along. People really want, just like your web inquiry there, but they don't want any ragged leaves on the rose bushes and things like that. But it's actually the consumer's demand for perfect things like that that drives a lot of pesticide use. I heard a statistic one time that 90% of the pesticide use in apple crops is to get the last 5% of quality of the fruit. So it's But we also say, well, if we could only change the consumer attitudes, we could really reduce pesticides. But people have said that for many years, and consumer attitudes don't seem to change. So I think that that's a, it's a logical thing to look at, but I'm not sure that that's going to be the solution to reducing pesticides.
Eric Stockstead from Science Magazine, do you see alternatives to replace pesticides soon in our arsenal in the distant future? I mean, what's the horizon look like?
There are a lot of interesting things happening. One is enhancing plants' own ability to protect themselves against insects. For example, using something called RNA interference. And what that can do is allow a plant to effectively kill an insect by having the insect destroy its own proteins. That is a couple of years away, probably, mm-hmm. from being incorporated. People, probably many of your callers won't be happy to know that Monsanto is likely to be the first out on the market with that. But that might be a useful tool. There are, in fact, a lot of just plain agronomic farming techniques that are going to be really important for battling herbicide-resistant weeds. So trying to reduce the amount of herbicides by doing things like plowing and handling the weeds in less chemically intensive ways. So
more to come. We'll be watching Eric Stockstead, and we appreciate your time today. Thank you. Edwin Rojat and Brenda Eskenazi, thank you very much. A terrific panel, important topic. You can continue the conversation, get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. Thanks to you listeners as well. This is On Point.